Hello, and welcome back for another episode of Mike on MedTech, a show on the MedTech Matters podcast channel. I'm Sean Fenske, editor-in-chief of MPO. Mike Drews, president of Vascular Sciences, is here, as always, to provide his insights and information. How you doing today, Mike?
I'm very well. Thank you, Sean, for asking.
Great. So this episode, we're taking a look at what is an annual list, the latest of those, by ECRI, which is an independent authority on healthcare technology and safety. They put out a top 10 health technology hazards list each year. This is the 2024 list. And Mike, while I don't want to, you know, necessarily focus on all of these, some of these are a little, you know, some of these are not necessarily med tech. I know there's a pharma one, and a few are more technology centric, you know, seem a little, maybe, I don't want to say obvious, but, you know, burns from electrosurgical system is not, you know, out of the realm of, you know, I don't think it requires much discussion. So I'd rather stick to the questions, or I'm sorry, the list items that really should generate a little more discussion between us. But, you know, before we do that, Mike, maybe if you would, you could explain what ECRI is and, you know, what the purpose of this list is.
I'd be happy to, Sean. And as always, thank you for the opportunity to have this discussion with you and your audience. And just a quick reply to your comment a moment ago about some of the more technology-specific risks that ECRI has identified, like the one that you mentioned, burns from surgery. Well, I would just point out that we've been doing surgery like this for decades, and yet burns continues to be a problem.
That's
so
true.
I understand that, you know, that it might not be worth focusing on, but even though we've been doing something for a long time, doesn't necessarily mean that we're doing it well. So
right.
just that's something to think about.
Still
anyway,
a valid concern.
Still definitely a valid concern, absolutely. So in terms of the ECRI, just a little background for the audience that is not familiar with them. The acronym stands for Emergency Care Research Institute. Emergency Care Research Institute. They were actually, you know, you might ask the question, well, what the heck did they have to do with medical devices? Well, the ECRI, Sean, actually started evaluating medical devices in 1971.
Wow.
1971. Do you happen to know, Sean, when FDA started evaluating medical devices?
you call me on the carpet because I know you've said it, but there's no way I remember that one. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. No worries. FDA started evaluating medical devices in 1976.
Okay.
So 5 years before FDA started regulating medical devices, the ECRA was evaluating them. And then they specifically with regard to this particular list that we're talking about, they started this list in 2008 and now we're in 2024. And for giggles, Sean, I pulled up a couple of the older lists, including the original 2008 list. And just like the burn example that we talked about a moment ago, unfortunately, Sean, history does tend to repeat itself because there are a few things that, you know, a few problems that they've identified that seem to show up, you know, from 2008
right.
until today. So it kind of reminds me of, you know, the most common reasons why FDA issues warning letters and 483 observations to companies. When you look at the most common reasons, in fact, these are the same reasons that companies have been getting these for over 15 years.
Right.
So just putting things in a little bit of perspective, just a tiny bit more on what ECRI does specifically with regard to medical devices. So basically the goal is to help identify safety issues with medical devices. We would like to assume, Sean, that once a device gets through the FDA onto the market, it is safe. Well, we both know, and I think all of us in this industry know, that that's not always the case. So so one of ECRI's goals is to help identify safety issues with medical devices, not pre-market, but post-market. This is another form of post-market surveillance. They also try to encourage manufacturers to make design improvements, all to ultimately reduce preventable problems. And regrettably, Sean, I take no pride in saying this, but most of the problems that we do run into are in fact preventable and predictable. But the biggest difference between the ECRI and the FDA in this regard, Sean, when it comes to medical devices, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this. The ECRI actually tests medical devices themselves, whereas the FDA does not. The FDA relies on data from the manufacturer or in some cases from third parties, but the FDA usually, in rare exception, does not test devices themselves. And by the way, there's been some very recent information out from FDA and in the popular press, Sean. Maybe this is a topic of another podcast. FDA urges independent evaluation of third-party testing data, because apparently the agency is reminding, the FDA is reminding medical device companies to evaluate the reliability of third-party testing before FDA submission, citing uptick in fabricated, duplicated, or unreliable data. So, and again, I think that would be the you know, a topic of a great discussion for the future. Right. But back to my original question, Sean. Do you think FDA should be evaluating medical devices directly themselves? In other words, the ECRI is kind of like a Consumer Reports magazine. For those that are familiar with Consumer Reports magazine, they rate and they test a wide variety of consumer products, from paint to computers to cars. But they buy the products just like you and I, and they test them themselves, and they publish the results, and they don't take any money from them, from the manufacturers. What do you think of that idea, Sean? I'm just curious.
I mean, I think ideally that the FDA as an independent body testing the devices would be fantastic. The unfortunate side of it is I can only imagine what the budget would require in order to achieve that. So in an agency that's already arguably understaffed or underfunded, you know, what would that look like? So that is obviously the counter to it, is what kind of financial commitment would it take for that to actually take place?
Well, that is a legitimate concern, and I don't want to belabor the point, but there is a solution to that problem. This is something that I've proposed several times over the years, and that is, let's create, whether it's within CDRH or a separate, like a Consumer Reports kind of an organization, where all medical device manufacturers would pay in a certain amount of money, maybe a percentage of their revenue or something like that, to this independent testing agency. And then that testing agency, whether it's FDA or somebody else, would do that testing of the medical devices. And of course, most companies, when I propose that idea, most companies, Sean, are adamantly against that idea. Do you want to speculate as to why?
Well, they don't want their products rated up against their competition. I mean, there's going to be a number one product, and then, gee, which one is going to be the market, is the market going to demand or want to buy?
That's one part of it. The other part of it is, Sean, is if they pay money into this to this lab that test devices themselves, they have no control over how the test is done, how the test is conducted, how the data is analyzed, and so on and so on. So these are solvable problems, but you know, coming up with a solution is not always easy. But anyway, let's go on to the content of the list, which I think is more important here.
Absolutely. So, all right. So number one on the list may not surprise many, but it's involving, you know, home-based devices. So specifically, ECRI indicates that medical devices may pose usability challenges for home users, risking misuse and patient harm. So, you know, Mike, like I said, I don't know that it's a tremendous surprise to have, patients using devices directly in the home as number one, but maybe you could speak to the issues that they're referring to with usability.
Yeah, great question, Sean. And usability is, as I'm sure our audience knows, is an important factor to consider in virtually all medical devices. In fact, it used to be up until about 7 or 8 years ago, the exception rather than the rule that usability testing was necessary. Now it's very much become the rule rather than the exception. And the precipitating event that occurred about 7, 8, 9 years ago was the whole infusion pump disaster that occurred when there were some 80 infusion pumps from a variety of different manufacturers that were having problems. Many of them were recalled, all because of usability related issues. That was the watershed moment, if you will, that basically led to usability testing being required almost across the board. But remember, Sean, most medical devices were originally intended to be used in some sort of a hospital or a medical institution. They were intended to be used. The intended user was a trained professional, a physician, a nurse, a surgeon, a pharmacist, whoever. It's only relatively more recently where we're having more and more medical devices that are intended to be used in the home by untrained or lay users. And now much more sophisticated devices are being used in the home by untrained lay users, things like still infusion pumps and ventilators and so on and so on. And unfortunately, Sean, many of these devices, even the ones that are used in the home today, many of them were never intended or were never designed to be used in the home. Now, some of them that are the most recent ones, they are, right? But I'm just saying, for medical devices across the board. And as a result, patients and caregivers may not have the experience necessary to operate them safely and effectively. Now, I'm sure many in our audience would counter, Sean, well, we have usability requirements, we do usability studies and so on and so on. That's all wonderful. But the reality of it is, most of those usability studies that we do, in my opinion, are conducted in the world of rainbows and unicorns, because they're not realistic of the way we practice medicine in the real world. And let me give you just a real quick example, Sean, and then we can continue on. Several years ago, I was giving a presentation at a conference, and coincidentally, the person presenting before me at the same conference was talking about a usability study for, I believe it was it wasn't a home use device, but it was a laparoscopic surgical device. And she said before the surgeon could use it, he or she had to read and follow the directions for use, or what many people call the instructions for use, the IFU. And I wanted to have a public debate over this. I said, well, you realize that by putting that in your inclusion and exclusion criteria in your usability study, that you have totally invalidated your entire usability study, because we all know that nobody reads, let alone follows that. And she says, yes, Mike, I agree with you 100%. However, it passed muster at the FDA. It passed mustard at the FDA. So I'll leave this as a rhetorical question, but feel free to comment if you want. What good is doing any testing, whether it's usability for a home use device or a clinical trial or anything else, if it's not realistic of the real world? And one last thing, Sean, that I'll point out, and I've made this suggestion many times, in the several usability guidances that FDA has put out in the last few years since the infusion pump fiasco, there is very, very little direct verbiage in there specifically about home use devices. Very, very little. Most of it is for the conventional devices, that is, the devices that are intended to be used in hospitals by trained professionals and so on. Very, very little for home use devices. And I have said publicly many times, in my professional opinion, that usability for a home use device is even more important than usability for a device that's being used by a medical professional. Any thoughts as to why that might be, Sean? Why do you think a usability of a home device would be more important? I'm not saying that usability for a device used by a trained professional is not important, but a home device is more important than a device for a trained professional. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I would think because, first of all, you're dealing with, well, that doesn't go to usability, but you're dealing with somebody who isn't a medical professional, so they're not familiar with exactly the data that they're looking to capture. They have no alternative also. There's no backup plan. You know, if you're in a hospital and they're using a digital capture for blood pressure, you know, if they have to, they can just resort to the old, cuff and pump, method and get blood pressure data that way. And, maybe the charts aren't working on the digital side and they can go to paper chart. There is backups in the hospital. If you're in the home and this is your device and your access to whatever data you need, that's it. You don't have another way to capture the necessary information.
And especially if it's a life supporting or a life sustaining kind of a device, like a ventilator that might be used in the home, then that could be, you know, that could be very, very problematic, obviously. All of those factors definitely go into it, Sean. But I think the key factor here is the assumption that the trained medical professional is, in fact, a trained medical professional. In other words, they went to medical school or nursing school or whatever it is, and they learned, you know, how these devices and these procedures are supposed to be done. And notice I'm saying that we're making that assumption because remember, Sean, back in the day, I used to teach medical school, and I often was reminded of the joke, what do we call the person that graduates last in their class in medical school?
Doctor.
Doctor, right. So that's still a big assumption. But when we're putting a device in somebody's, in a lay user's hands, that's a completely different story. And I think further, for us to just assume that they're going to read and follow for the directions for use, many, many, many people make that assumption, Sean. But I think it's not a good assumption. I mean, after all, if you go to Walmart and buy a toaster, for example, are you going to read the instructions before you use it, or are you going to just simply plug it into the wall and put the bread in and
just plug it in and try it?
There you go. I think medical devices are the same.
Yeah, and you couple that with you know, some devices are being supported by a smartphone for the interface or for the readout, or, you know, just there's some connection to a smartphone. I mean, my father, he doesn't even like the flip phone. Forget about a smartphone with a with a screen and buttons, and, you know, he won't even do the flip. He doesn't even like the flip phone. So, you know, you have that whole element. Now, that may change in 20, 30 years where, you know, when we're older and we're used to that type of technology. But who knows what the technology will be in 20, 30 years and whether or not we're comfortable with that. So, you know, there are assumptions with home medical devices being made that the user, A, might have a smartphone or a computer or a laptop, and B, is comfortable enough to use it to have an effect on their health.
Well, I like to say, Sean, if I have to read the manual for any product, and keep in mind, this is coming from somebody who has a PhD in biomedical engineering. If I have to read the manual, if I have to read the directions for use, some engineer did not do their job. Products should be designed as much as possible to be intuitive and so on. But anyway, the point of this is ECRI has pointed out usability, especially usability of home use devices as a big problem. And I agree, it is a problem, but it's a recurring problem. This is certainly not new. It's been going on for many years.
Right.
All of these topics, I'm sure, Sean, could be topics of, you know, individual podcasts themselves. So maybe we should move on to the next one.
Sounds good. So the second one involves cleaning, specifically inadequate or onerous device cleaning instructions. So it's really not about, you know, whether a hospital has the proper cleaning protocols, but rather, again, we you know, go back to the instructions. The instructions for cleaning are unclear, maybe not specific enough. So, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, great question, Sean. So when it comes to cleaning, or just to be proper, let's talk about reprocessing, because it's a little bit different than just cleaning. I mentioned a moment ago when we talked about usability testing, and I said the precipitating event there was the infusion pump disaster. Well, the precipitating event here for reprocessing, I don't know if you remember, Sean, back in 2015, the 100 people, more than 100 people that were exposed, and a few people died because of infections at UCLA due to the duodenoscope fiasco, as I like to call it. And in the interest of full disclosure, Sean, this is a topic that I'm intimately involved with because I was one of many that was invited to come to FDA to talk at the panel meeting when we were talking about this case. So this is something that I'm very, very familiar with. These patients were exposed to super bacteria. I love this phrase, super bacteria. Super bacteria is nothing more than an antibiotic resistant bacteria. Right. And a lot of people think that antibiotic resistance is only a problem in the drug world, Sean. But in fact, antibiotic resistance is a problem in the medical device world as well, because if a person, like for example, gets an infection from a duodenoscope that was not properly reprocessed since the last patient, that now becomes a medical device problem. And as we know, Sean, not to go off on too many tangents here, but several years ago, CMS announced that they're not, no longer going to be in reimbursing hospitals for hospital-based infections. Right. So this remains a huge problem, even though ECRI is pointing it out as a number two today. This has been going on for a long time. I was one of the people that have been talking for many years about the concept of design for reprocessing. In other words, if we have a medical device that's intended to be reused, in other words, not a single-use medical device, and especially if it's a complicated medical device, like a duodenoscope or like a ventilator or a CPAP machine or something like mm-hmm. that, these things should be designed to be reprocessed. And by the way, just to go off on, you know, a quick tangent, John, I mentioned CPAP machines for people that have difficulty breathing, you know, during the night, they stop breathing. They have very, very long, very, very poor long-term efficacy rates, very poor across the board, regardless of the manufacturer. Any speculation as to why, Sean?
Well, go back to a list item number one, that they're a home-use medical device, and you're relying on the patient, the user, to, you know, set it up correctly, properly mount the mask, you know, the way it should be, or on their face, or, you know, on their head. And you're relying on a non-medical professional to facilitate its use.
That's part of it, although I don't think it's the biggest part. The biggest part is, quite frankly, these CPAP machines are a pain in the ass to clean. Pain. I hate to be blunt, but they are.
Right.
And most people, you know, after, you know, using them for a few weeks or a few months, they say, you know, that they're just simply a pain in the ass to clean. Right. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know if it's a great metaphor, but people that go out and buy a treadmill and then they use it for a few days or a few weeks, and then after that they use it to hang their clothing on. You know, so this concept for, you know, design for reprocessing, in other words, if you have a complicated device, you should design it so that it can be easily taken apart and cleaned. To me, that's basic common sense, Sean, but right. Unfortunately, we don't do that very often. And back in 2015, when the UCLA problem occurred, I actually published a column called "Can We Design Medical Devices to Be Reprocessed Without Killing People?" I think the short answer is absolutely yes, but it does require some thought in the early engineering, you know, not just to meet the label claims, but also if it's going to be reprocessed, to make sure that the user, whether it's somebody in their home or it's a trained professional in a hospital that would be reprocessing a duodenoscope, that they can reprocess it effectively.
Right.
And before moving on, Sean, just a couple of other comments on reprocessing from the regulatory side. The question is, who regulates reprocessing of medical devices? It's an interesting question because it depends on who's doing the reprocessing as well as where the reprocessing is being done. So, for example, take the duodenoscope. And this is an example that I pointed out in the panel meeting as well as at FDA many times since then. If the reprocessing is done in the hospital by hospital personnel, it is not regulated by the FDA because that is considered to be the practice of medicine, just like right. pharmaceutical compounding and lab developed tests and so on. However, if exactly the same medical device, the duodenoscope, is sent out to some kind of a third party lab and is reprocessed and then sent back, now FDA does regulate the reprocessing. Does right. that make sense? Doesn't really make sense to me, but it must make sense to somebody because that's right. exactly what the guidance says that came out in 2015. I think that needs to be cleaned up. The other thing that I would point out in the guidance that I think is to be very, very kind here, is an inadequacy at best. They do, FDA does require now valid reprocessing methods for all devices intended to be reused and reprocessed. Valid reprocessing methods, a valid reprocessing instruction or protocol. But they don't talk about who is doing the validation. In other words, and I still see it happen today where people in the company, the medical device company, will validate the reprocessing method, but they're not the ones that are doing the reprocessing after the fact. You know, what's the, you know, it's somebody else. It's somebody in the hospital or somebody, you know, in a third party lab that's doing the reprocessing. Just because a company employee can successfully reprocess the device does not necessarily mean that some external person, especially somebody working in a hospital. And again, I don't want to be unkind or patronizing Sean, but let's be honest, the people that are doing this kind of work are not exactly the MDs and the PhDs of the world, if you know what I mean.
Right.
You know, and I saw in one case, and I presented this at FDA for one particular medical device that was intended to be reprocessed in the hospital. The manual, the reprocessing instruction manual, was over 600 pages
long.
Do we really expect anybody that kind of a job that's going to, you know, again, I'm not trying to be demeaning. I'm really not. But I just am being realistic. I just think that is totally nuts. But once again, to their credit, ECRI is mentioning this on their list. It's number two. Right. Definitely not a new problem. It's been going on for a long time. But still, there's a lot of room for improvement.
Absolutely. All right. So we're going to move down the list. So number three was a pharmaceutical related one, compounding. I'm going to skip over that one. But the fourth one involving certainly a buzzword, certainly a leading trend in the industry right now, and that was involving sustainability. So specifically, ECRI states this one as overlooked environmental impacts of patient care endanger public health. So, you know, I don't know if this is more of a design issue or, you know, if we're looking at something else here, but, you know, Mike, what's your take on it?
Well, it's an interesting one, Sean. And to be honest, when I first looked at this one, I was scratching my head as well as to how to approach it. But I think there's two ways to approach this. From a sustainability issue, some of the recommendations that ECRI provides here, which I think are good ones, is we want to do whatever we can to reduce the amount of energy that's consumed when products are being used. They, for example, use medical imaging equipment as an example, minimize the amount of anesthetic gases that have an impact on global warming and so on. So those are certainly valuable things to address. The manufacturer should address as much as they can from a sustainability, a global perspective, if you will. But quite frankly, Sean, from an FDA/regulatory perspective, they could care less how much energy, how much electricity your CT machine uses, or, you know, what happens to the anesthesia gas that leaks out. I mean, I don't want to be too cavalier. I don't mean that they don't care from a personal sense, but they certainly do not care from a regulatory sense. EPA or somebody else might care. However, the other piece of this, which I think is under direct FDA regulation and is important for our industry to understand, is the packaging concerns. You know, obviously, in surgery, for example, we often use the three-layer packaging technique, where you actually have three layers of packaging, you know, around a particular product.
Right.
Well, we all know in, you know, for consumer products and in the grocery store and so on and so on, there's a strong trend to get rid of as much of that kind of packaging as we can, because it all ends up in landfills and, you know, all these other things. So I know this is not an area that I work on a lot, John, but I do some work in this area. I know there are some companies that are working on more environmentally friendly packaging for medical products. But of course, at the end of the day, the most important thing here is safety and efficacy, specifically sterility and shelf life and stability and so on and so on. So, I think it's good that ECRI is reminding us of this as something that we should be concerned about, even though it might not be in some ways a regulatory concern, although in some ways it is, but it's certainly a sustainability concern.
Right. Yeah. It might be considered a little surprising to be number three number four on the list. It's higher than a couple others that, you know, you could argue are more important. But I mean, you know, I guess the full list is the full list. So
yeah,
where they rank, I don't know, is as important.
I mentioned, in the reprocessing discussion a few minutes ago, I mentioned what I call design for reprocessing.
Right.
That is sort of an extension of the idea of design for manufacturing. That's where I kind of came up with that. But ECRI now is taking it a step further with with sustainability. And basically they're saying design products with sustainability in mind. So design for sustainability. So we're going to have a very long list of design criteria, Sean, before we know it.
That's right. Absolutely. All right. So moving along, we've got number five on the list, which calls out insufficient governance of AI used in medical technologies risks inappropriate care decisions. So I was a little unsure where they're going with this one. So, you know, is this a matter of, you know, relying too heavily on decisions or actions being flagged by AI? Or, you know, are they just, you know, ensuring that there is a clinician, you know, being mindful of these call outs by AI and, you know, verifying the findings?
Well, first of all, Sean, once again, this is a topic that could very easily be a discussion in and of itself, if not multiple discussions. And I'm sure over the years we've been doing these podcasts, you and I have talked about AI directly and indirectly in several occasions. Couple of things. First of all, I would not agree with the presumption that you just made, and that is that we want to make sure that the physician is in the loop, so to speak. Mm-hmm. While it is true that for the vast majority, in fact, nearly all of current medical devices that do claim to use AI, and by the way, Sean, most of the devices that I see that claim to use AI, I don't know what they're smoking. They must be smoking their socks because I don't see any AI in it. I don't see any, you know, intelligence in it, artificial or otherwise.
Right.
But on the contrary, in the future, I want to have lots of devices that do not require the physician at all. In other words, the AI, whether it's software or hardware or a combination of the two, will be just as good or if not better by itself than it would be, to having to have a clinician or a human being kind of second guess it. We're not there yet. And this is why FDA introduced several years ago this concept of the locked algorithm, which I've said publicly and privately at FDA many, many times. I think it's an absolutely archaic concept. The idea, for those that are not familiar with it, is once the product gets to design freeze, we disable its ability to learn and to evolve. In other words, there's no more artificial intelligence to it. It now becomes a piece of static software. And to call that AI, Sean, in my opinion, is a misnomer. I mean, true AI, by definition, is software that can learn and evolve in very much a Darwinian way. Darwinian evolution way. Well, when we prevent the software from doing that, how can we call that AI anymore? So right. in the short term, FDA, you know, because of all the obvious concerns of, when software can get out there and change and so on, how do we have checks and balances? And by the way, Sean, those are all solvable problems. So beyond the scope of today's talk, but they're all solvable problems. In the short term, FDA introduced this concept of the locked algorithm a few years ago, and I understand why they did, and they're being conservative, and that's, of course, their job. But the unfortunate reality, Sean, is it is really holding us back. And because I don't like to use regulation or the FDA as an excuse to hold me back, I have several customers. I'm among, you know, some of the first people that are working on devices with true AI that can learn and evolve, that are not using this archaic locked algorithm contact, that are going on to the market. So these are all solvable problems. But the other thing that ECRA points out, and I think this is worth mentioning, Sean, and then I would love to hear your thoughts on this, and that is AI systems are only as good as the algorithms they use and the data that in which they're trained on. I agree 100%, but I don't think that's unique to AI. Any medical device, whether it's a piece of AI software or not, any medical device is only as good as the person that's using it, whether it's a doctor or a patient or whoever, and their training that they may have received or didn't receive to use it. So a lot of people think that when it comes to software and especially AI, there's a lot of stuff that's new here. In fact, Sean, I find very, very little to be new. If you understand the medical device universe in general, and if you understand the regulation, what I mean there is the regulatory logic, not what the regulation says, but the intent of the regulation, what's new here? I don't see anything new. Your thoughts, Sean?
Yeah, no, I think you know, you know, to go back to what you were saying about AI and you know, working with true AI. I mean, I think, you know, especially like I think the easy example is diagnostics, whether it be imaging or testing. You know, letting the AI learn from all these cases that it's being used for to further assess patients and find those markers that are you know, indicating the most likely diagnosis of a condition. So, you know, we may diagnose a condition with metric A, B, and C, and through AI's learning and experience, it finds a D. And D might be a bigger indicator than A, B, and C. And you're not going to have that if you have what you mentioned before, that locked algorithm. So yeah, so there's certainly an advantage to having this you know, quote unquote unlocked AI or unrestricted AI, but at the same time, there do need to be those checks and balances in place.
And perfect example, Sean, using your imaging. You know, I work with a lot of imaging companies that are now using or developing AI to help interpret the imaging. So, for example, if you have a mammogram and you have it analyzed by software using artificial intelligence. First of all, there are very, very few companies that have gone so far to say that the patient has a tumor or breast cancer or something like that. Instead, what they're doing, and this is my regulatory advice for the moment, although I don't like the advice myself, is don't make that diagnosis because you're going to require a heck of a lot more data to support that. Instead, to say, hey, there seems to be something funky going on, and you, Dr. Smith, take a closer look. But we can go well beyond that. And you know, eventually, Sean, I don't want the doctor to have to review the image. I want the software to be able to say, yes, this patient has, you know, a tumor here. It appears like it might be breast cancer, and therefore I, meaning the software, recommend a biopsy or some further kind of a analysis, something like that. So it's kind of like, you know, the people are so apprehensive today, Sean, about the self-driving cars. But what they don't realize is we've had self-driving airplanes for a very long time. What happens after the airplane takes off? They put on autopilot. Nobody seems to be concerned about that, but now they're all concerned about self-driving cars. So I understand, you know, self-driving cars are still, they have some bugs to be worked out, but those are all technologically solvable problems. I'm 100% confident of that. Just one last comment I wanted to bring up with regard to AI, Sean, before we move to the last topic that we wanted to talk about in the ECRI list is there's been an interesting debate at FDA and outside of FDA over the last several months as to whether or not companies should be required to disclose in their labeling, specifically their high-level labeling, the intended use and the indications for use, if they're using AI in their medical device. If they're using AI, some companies say that, some companies don't. A lot of companies do like to say it because of marketing reasons. It sounds Star Trek-y. But out of curiosity, Sean, do you have any thoughts on if a company uses AI, do you think they should have to disclose that in their labeling?
I mean, my knee jerk is to say, yeah, of course they should. But then I start to think about it. It's like, well, if they use, you know, what other, where's the line? You know, why are we singling out the technology of AI versus the technology of a robotic system? You know, do you have to, you know, if you're getting a surgery, and I honestly, I don't know the answer to this. If you're getting a surgery, is the hospital obligated to tell you a robotic surgical system will be used as part of your surgery? Is the doctor obligated to tell you that, or is that just something they might share with you, but you know, do you know for sure? Is it a I don't want to say legal, but is it an obligation of the hospital to disclose that?
Good question, Sean. And without going off onto too much of a tangent, there is informed consent that is required here. And part of that informed consent for a surgery is to provide some information about, you know, what the surgery is, its purpose, the risks, and so on. But there's no requirement to go, you know, down the list and say, I'm going to use scalpel 1, 2, 3 from this company and hemostat 123 from that company and robotic surgery, you know, device XYZ from this other company. Right. Many surgeons, I suspect, would probably say to the patient that they're probably going to be, you know, operated on using robotic assistance. It's not robotic surgery, it's robotic assistance. There's a big difference. But there, as far as I know, Sean, there's no regulatory or statutory obligation. I don't see how there could be, because I know for a fact there's no obligation to specify what other devices that are being used in that particular device. In that particular procedure.
Yeah. Where do we draw the line on what technology is being singled out? What technology? AI is just simply a technology. It's simply a tool.
That's exactly.
Part of, it's or a component even. You want to call it a component.
It's kind of like another example, Sean, a hip implant. Is it required to disclose that you're going to get a hip implant from one company or another company?
I can't say for sure whether it's disclosed, whether or not it's in paperwork, but I ask people all the time, because I I'm editor of ODT, which is Orthopedic Centric. Oh, you're getting a knee implant? What company?
Yeah.
Oh, you're getting a hip implant? What company? Yeah. Nobody knows. Ask them what kind of car they want to buy. They know exactly which brands they want. Ask them what knee implant is going inside of their body, and they say, I have no idea. Whatever the doctor's, doctor may have mentioned it, but I don't know.
I'm surprised to hear that, Sean, because I thought, especially in the case of the hip implant, they would know because of all of the problems associated with some of the different implants.
I don't think they want to know. I think they're just, they trust their doctor, but no, okay. I mean, I've asked people all the time just for that. Oh, you're getting a knee implant? Oh, what are you getting? What are you getting? And I don't know. I'll ask next time and then let you know. How do you not know? It's a device going into the body for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's interesting. See, we both learn something new every day. All right, let's move on to the last ECRI topic that we were going to talk about today.
All right, number five, another topic that number six on the list, but anyway, a topic that I find very important, and unfortunately, I still accuse the industry of lagging behind. The FDA has gotten on board now with their regulations, but I still accuse the industry of lagging behind, and that is cybersecurity. At number six on the list, specifically, it is listed as ransomware targeting the healthcare sector remains a critical threat. So a little vague in what the, you know, what they're actually targeting, but this ties in directly to the significant efforts being put forth to ensure connected devices have a cybersecurity plan in place. At least that's my read of it. Mike, do you agree, or am I a little bit off the mark?
Yeah, well, I do agree, Sean, with one sort of caveat. I'm a little hesitant to use the words ransomware and cybersecurity synonymously. I think ransomware, to me, and I'm not an expert on ransomware, so this is just my sort of, you know, layperson understanding, that's a subset of cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is a much broader topic. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think the general context of ransomware is somebody, you know, takes over your software and kind of holds it hostage until you do something for them or give them something or pay them something or something like that. And while that's certainly a concern, that's not the biggest concern that I have here. And that's why I think that we should, you know, broaden out the discussion of this to cybersecurity. I'm not part of ECRI, so maybe they, you know, they meant cybersecurity here, but for the purposes of our discussion, I think we should talk about cybersecurity a little more broadly. And I looked it up, Sean. We actually did a podcast. We've talked about it several times, but we did a podcast specifically on cybersecurity a couple of years ago, back in 2021. Maybe it's worthy to go back and update that. The examples that ECRI provides in terms of ransomware or cybersecurity are, for example, preventing clinician access to information needed to make care decisions, possibly forcing the closure of a medical office or clinical unit. Those are certainly concerns, but those are not concerns to the FDA. Those are certainly not concerns from a regulatory perspective.
Right.
The cybersecurity concerns that are of most interest to the FDA have nothing to do with these kinds of concerns that they mention. It has nothing to do with identity theft. The cybersecurity concerns that are important to the FDA are concerns that could potentially directly impact the safety and efficacy of the device. These are the most important concerns that I have in the area of cybersecurity, at least from a regulatory perspective. And by the way, Sean, I mentioned, you know, in a few of the other examples, the precipitating event that led to these things. Do you remember, you know, everybody today is talking about cybersecurity, including at the FDA, but do you remember, or can you guess what I think is the precipitating event that led to the discussion publicly as well as at the FDA about cybersecurity of specifically medical devices?
Well, there's two that I can think of right off the top of my head. There was one, the real world issue of WannaCry, which affected a lot of healthcare providers. That was a virus that was infiltrating all industries. But number two was the television show where I never saw the episode, but the vice president had a pacemaker and it was hacked in the show. And, you know, that suddenly became a critical concern.
Yeah, that second one is what I was alluding to, Sean, and that's what I'd like to drill into a little bit here, because it demonstrates how the Secret Service implemented one of my risk mitigation strategies that I mentioned, early on in this process, probably back in that podcast that I just referred to. So yeah, the TV show Homeland, which I was a big fan of that, one episode back in 2013, a decade ago, Sean, 2013, was where somebody hacked into the vice president of the United States' pacemaker, right, and threatened to kill them. And coincidentally, Sean, the vice president Cheney, who was in office at the time, was watching that episode.
Right.
And long story short, the vice president Cheney's physicians deactivated the wireless capability of the pacemaker in the ICD for that particular device, in order to prevent this from happening. So one of the recommendations that I made, it's a bit of an overkill, I admit, it's putting in using a sledgehammer to put in a thumbtack. But if you want to really not have to worry about cybersecurity or any threats from the outside, just make sure that nobody can talk to your device, either via the internet, via Wi-Fi, via Bluetooth, via telephone. Now, of course, that's not a practical solution for lots of kinds of devices that we have today. But if they really want to guarantee that they can't get to it, at least not, you know, in a sense like that, isolate it. So, again, I think, you know, kudos for ECRA for bringing up this, you know, in their top 10 list. I definitely think that it should be in the top 10 list. But once again, Sean, there's nothing new for me here. You know, this problem, just like, you know, many of the other problems that we've talked about, you know, they've been going on for a very, very long time. There's definitely certainly room for improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and if nothing else, the list does serve as a reminder for, you know, and again, there's, you know, we didn't cover numbers 7 through 10, which several of them were more technology centric. But again, as you pointed out at the start, items that have been on the list for years, you know, maybe even a decade or two since they've been doing this since 71. But I think, you know, it ultimately serves as a good reminder for designers, for medical device firms, for really everyone, FDA even, to, you know, on things to just keep in mind as these devices are progressing and being developed. But Mike, as I always do, I'd like to give you the last word. You know, what are your final thoughts, final closing comments on the list, on any of the items that we covered? Feel free to take it away.
Well, thank you, Sean. And as always, thanks for the opportunity to have this conversation with you and your audience. First and foremost, I just want to give a kudos, a special shout out to ECRI. I am not affiliated with them directly, but I do have a lot of respect for their work. And I think that their work is very important. And I would like to see it even expanded, you know, more for all the reasons that we talked about before. This idea of medical device companies either testing their devices themselves and submitting it to the FDA, or hiring somebody to test it and then submitting it to the FDA. It doesn't take a PhD in philosophy to appreciate that, gee, maybe there might be a conflict of interest there. So that's something that we should kind of think about. But specifically with regard to, you know, the people listening in the industry here, I also want to remind everybody that even the five topics that we highlighted in today's discussion, we just barely scratched the surface. I mean, each of these topics can easily be a discussion in and of itself. Right. If you're working in these areas, and I suspect many of you are, I suggest you do have these discussions within your company about how these kinds of issues can and, you know, may affect you in the future. Because I'll just end with, you know, the common adage, Sean, and that is, those who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. Those who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. Well, given the fact that, as I said at the beginning, and if you agree, you said as well, many of these items that they list in the 2024 list go back, you know, years or decades, even to the original 2008 list. And as I said at the beginning, many of the reasons why companies get 483 observations and warning letters from the FDA are exactly the same reasons why companies have gotten these things for years slash decades. Do we really learn from our history? Or is it, you know, are we doomed to repeat it?
Right, right.
Those words are easy to say. They're easy to put on a PowerPoint slide. They're easy for a politician to say. But in this era of, you know, evidence-based medicine, where is the proof?
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think you're going to always have a case where people seek the, I don't want to say quote-unquote easy route, but, you know, they'll definitely go the path of least resistance, even if it means running the risk of repeating history, repeating mistakes, and not learning from the past. So, you know, you'll certainly always have that contingent, unfortunately, but you know, that's how it's been. And that's, I don't expect that to change anytime soon. So unfortunately, that is all the time we have for this episode of Mike on MedTech, though. I'd like to thank Mike Drews, as always, for, you know, being very forthcoming with his insights and information and experience and a few stories along the way. And, you know, of course, I'd like to thank you, the listeners, for tuning in. Until next time, this has been Sean Fenske, Editor-in-Chief of Medical Product Outsourcing, saying thanks for listening.